to the day, much less the rest of my life, but it also seemed worth trying. Trip 3, 5-MeO-DMT, or the toad. Yes, the toad, or to be more precise, the smoked venom of the Sonoran desert toad, Incilius alvarius, also called the Colorado River toad, which contains a molecule called 5-MeO-DMT that is one of the most potent and fast-acting psychotropic drugs there is. No, I had never heard of it either. It is so obscure, in fact, that the federal government did not list 5-MeO-DMT as a controlled substance until 2011. The opportunity to smoke the toad popped up suddenly, giving me very little time to decide if doing so was crazy or not. I got a call from one of my sources, a woman who is training to become a certified psychedelic guide, inviting me to meet her friend Rocio, a 35-year-old Mexican therapist whom she described as probably the world's leading expert on the toad. Though how intense really could the competition for that title be? Rocio is from the state of Sonora in northern Mexico, where she collects the toads and milks their venom. She administers the medicine to people both in Mexico, where its legal status is gray, and in the United States, where it isn't. It doesn't appear to be on the official radar, however. Rocio worked in a clinic in Mexico that treated drug addicts with a combination of iboga, a psychedelic plant from Africa, and 5-MeO-DMT, apparently with striking rates of success. In recent years, she's become the Johnny Appleseed of toad, traveling all over North America with her capsules of crystallized venom and her vaporizer. As my circle of psychonauts expanded, most anyone I met who'd had an encounter with the toad had been introduced to it by Rocio. The first time I met Rocio at a small dinner organized by our mutual friend, she told me about the toad and what I might expect from it. Rocio was petite, pretty, and fashionably dressed, her shoulder-length black hair cut to frame her face with bangs. She has an easy smile that brings out a dimple on one cheek. Not at all what I expected. Rocio looked less the part of a shaman or curandera than that of an urban professional. After going to college and working for a few years in the United States, 5 years ago, Rocio found herself back at home in Mexico, living with her parents and without direction. Online, she found a manual about the toad, which she learned was native to the local desert. Its habitat extends the length of the Sonoran Desert north into Arizona. 9 months of the year, the toad lives underground, protected from the desert sun and heat, but when the winter rains come, it emerges at night from its burrow for a brief orgy of eating and copulation. Following the instructions spelled out in the manual, Rocio strapped on a headlamp and went hunting for toads. "They're not very hard to catch," she told me. "They freeze in the beam of light, so you can just grab them. The toads, which are warty, sand-colored, and roughly the size of a man's hand, have a large gland on each side of their necks and smaller ones on their legs. You gently squeeze the gland while holding a mirror in front of it to catch the spray. The toad is apparently none the worse for being milked. Overnight, the venom dries on the glass, turning into flaky crystals the color of brown sugar. In its natural state, the venom is toxic, a defense chemical sprayed by the toad when it feels threatened. But when the crystals are volatilized, the toxins are destroyed, leaving behind the 5-MeO-DMT. Rocio vaporizes the crystals in a glass pipe while the recipient inhales. Before you've had a chance to exhale, you are gone. The toad comes on quickly, she said, and at first it can be unbelievably intense. I noticed that Rocio personified the toad and seldom called the medicine by its molecular name. Some people remain perfectly still. Other people scream and flail, especially when the toad brings out traumas, which it can do. A few people will vomit. And then, after 20 or 30 minutes, the toad is all done and it leaves. My first instinct when facing such a decision is to read as much about it as I can. And later that night, Rocio emailed me a few articles. But the pickings were slim. Unlike most other psychedelics, which by now have been extensively studied by scientists and, in many cases, in use for hundreds if not thousands of years, the toad has been known to Western science only since 1992. That's when Andrew Weil and Wade Davis published a paper called Identity of a New World Psychoactive Toad. They had been inspired to look for such a fantastical creature by the images of frogs in Mayan art. But the only psychoactive toad they could find lives far to the north of Mayan civilization. It's possible that these toads became an item of trade, but as yet there is no proof that the practice of smoking toad venom has any antiquity whatsoever. However, 5-MeO-DMT also occurs in a handful of South American plants, and there are several Amazonian tribes who pound these plants into a snuff for use in shamanic rituals. Among some of these tribes, these snuffs are known as the semen of the sun. I couldn't find much in the way of solid medical information about the potential side effects or dangerous drug interactions. Little research has been done. What I did find were plenty of trip reports online, and many of these were terrifying. I also learned there was someone in town, a friend of a friend I had met a few times at dinner parties, who had tried 5-MeO-DMT, not the toad, but a synthetic version of the active ingredient. I took her out to lunch to see what I could learn. "This is the Everest of psychedelics," she began portentously, putting a steadying hand on my forearm. Olivia is in her early 50s, a management consultant with a couple of kids. I had vaguely known she was into Eastern religion, but had no idea she was a psychonaut, too. "You need to be prepared," she said. Over grilled cheeses, she described a harrowing onset. "I was shot out into an infinite realm of pure being. There were no figures in this world, no entities of any kind, just pure being. And it was huge. I didn't know what infinity was before this. But it was a two-dimensional realm, not three, and after the rush of liftoff, I found myself installed in this infinite space as a star. I remember thinking, if this is death, I'm fine with it. It was bliss. I had the feeling, no, the knowledge that every single thing there is made of love. After what seemed like an eternity but was probably only minutes, you start to reassemble and come back into your body. I had the thought, there are children to raise, and there is an infinite amount of time to be dead." I asked her the question that gnawed at me whenever someone recounted such a mystical experience. "How can you be sure this was a genuine spiritual event and not just a drug experience?" "It's an irrelevant question," she replied coolly. "This was something being revealed to me." There it was, the noetic sense William James had described as a mark of the mystical experience. I envied Olivia's certainty, which I suppose is the reason I decided I would smoke the toad. The night before my date with Rocio was, predictably, sleepless. Yes, I'd come through these first two trips intact, grateful even for having gone on them, and had come away with the idea I was stronger, physically and mentally, than I had previously thought. But now all of the old fears rushed back, assailing me through the long, fitful night. Everest! Could my heart take the intensity of those first harrowing moments of ascent? What were the chances I'd go mad? Slim, perhaps, but surely not zero. So was this an absolutely insane thing to do? On the plus side, I figured whatever happened, it would all be over in half an hour. On the negative side, everything might be over in half an hour. As the sun came up, I decided I would decide when I got there. Rocio, whom I'd made aware of my trepidations, had offered to let me watch her work with someone else before it was my turn. This proved reassuring, as she knew it would. The guy before me, a supremely low-affect college student who had done the toad once before, took a puff from Rocio's pipe, lay back on a mattress, and embarked on what appeared to be a placid 30-minute nap, during which he exhibited no signs of distress, let alone existential terror. After it was over, he seemed perfectly fine. A great deal had gone on in his mind, he indicated, but from the looks of it, his body had scarcely been perturbed. Okay, then. Death or madness seemed much less likely. I could do this. After positioning me on the mattress just so, Rocio had me sit up while she loaded a pre-measured capsule of the crystals into a glass vial that she then screwed onto the barrel of the pipe. She asked me to give thanks to the toad and think about my intention, something fairly generic about learning whatever the toad had to teach me. Rocio lit a butane flame underneath the vial and instructed me to draw on the pipe in short sips of air as the white smoke swirled and then filled the glass. Then one big final draw that I want you to hold for as long as you can. I have no memory of ever having exhaled or of being lowered onto the mattress and covered with a blanket. All at once, I felt a tremendous rush of energy fill my head, accompanied by a punishing roar. I managed barely to squeeze out the words I had prepared, trust and surrender. These words became my mantra. But they seemed utterly pathetic, wishful scraps of paper in the face of this Category 5 mental storm. Terror seized me, and then, like one of those flimsy wooden houses erected on Bikini Atoll to be blown up in the nuclear tests, I was no more, blasted to a confetti cloud by an explosive force I could no longer locate in my head because it had exploded that too, expanding to become all that there was. Whatever this was, it was not a hallucination. A hallucination implies a reality and a point of reference and an entity to have it. None of those things remained. Unfortunately, the terror didn't disappear with the extinction of my eye. Whatever allowed me to register this experience, the post-egoic awareness I'd first experienced on mushrooms, was now consumed in the flames of terror too. In fact, every touchstone that tells us I exist was annihilated, and yet I remained conscious. Is this what death feels like? Could this be it? That was the thought, though there was no longer a thinker to have it. Here, words fail. In truth, there were no flames, no blast, no thermonuclear storm. I'm grasping at metaphor in the hope of forming some stable and shareable concept of what was unfolding in my mind. In the event, there was no coherent thought, just pure and terrible sensation. Only afterwards did I wonder if this was what the mystics call the mysterium tremendum, the blinding, unendurable mystery, whether of God or some other ultimate or absolute, before which humans tremble in awe. Huxley described it as the fear, quote, of being overwhelmed, of disintegrating under a pressure of reality greater than a mind accustomed to living most of the time in a cozy world of symbols could possibly bear. Oh, to be back in the cozy world of symbols. After the fact, I kept returning to one of two metaphors, and while they inevitably deform the experience, as any words or metaphors or symbols must, they at least allow me to grasp hold of a shadow of it, and perhaps share it. The first is the image of being on the outside of a rocket after launch. I'm holding on with both hands, legs clenched around it, while the rapidly mounting G-forces clutch at my flesh, pulling my face down into a taut grimace as the great cylinder rises through successive layers of clouds, exponentially gaining speed and altitude, the fuselage shuddering on the brink of self-destruction as it strains to break free from Earth's grip. While the friction it generates as it crashes through the thinning air issues in a deafening roar. It was a little like that. The other metaphor was the Big Bang, but the Big Bang run in reverse, from our familiar world all the way back to a point before there was anything, no time or space or matter, only the pure, unbounded energy that was all there was then, before an imperfection, a ripple in its waveform, caused the universe of energy to fall into time, space, and matter. Rushing backward through 14 billion years, I watched the dimensions of reality collapse one by one until there was nothing left, not even being, only the all-consuming roar. It was just horrible. And then suddenly, the devolution of everything into the nothingness of pure force reverses course. One by one, the elements of our universe begin to reconstitute themselves, the dimensions of time and space returning first, blessing my still scattered confetti brain with the cozy coordinates of place. This is somewhere. And then I slip back into my familiar eye like an old pair of slippers and soon after felt something I recognized as my body begin to reassemble. The film of reality was now running in reverse, as if all the leaves that the thermonuclear blast had blown off the great tree of being and scattered to the four winds were suddenly to find their way back, fly up into the welcoming limbs of reality, and reattach. The order of things was being restored, me notably included. I was alive. The descent and reentry into familiar reality was swifter than I expected. Having undergone the shuddering agony of launch, I expected to be deposited weightless into orbit, my installation in the firmament as a blissed-out star. Alas, like those first Mercury astronauts, my flight remained suborbital, describing an arc that only kissed the serenity of infinite space before falling back down to Earth. And yet, as I felt myself reconstitute as a self and then a body, something for which I now sought confirmation by running my hands along my legs and squirming beneath the blanket, I felt ecstatic, as happy as I can remember ever feeling. But this ecstasy was not sui generis, not exactly. It was more like the equal and opposite reaction to the terror I had just endured, less of a divine gift than the surge of pleasure that comes from the cessation of unendurable pain. But a sense of relief so vast and deep as to be cosmic. With the rediscovery of my body, I felt an inexplicable urge to lift my knees, and as soon as I raised them, I felt something squeeze out from between my legs, but easily and without struggle or pain. It was a boy, the infant me. That seemed exactly right. Having died, I was now being reborn. Yet as soon as I looked closely at this new being, it morphed smoothly into Isaac, my son. And I thought, how fortunate, how astounding for a father to experience the perfect physical intimacy that heretofore only mothers have ever had with their babies. Whatever space had ever intervened between my son and me now closed, and I could feel the warm tears sliding down my cheeks. Next came an overwhelming wave of gratitude. For what? For once again existing, yes, for the existence of Isaac and Judith too, but also for something even more fundamental. I felt for the first time gratitude for the very fact of being, that there is anything whatsoever. Rather than being necessarily the case, this now seemed quite the miracle, and something I resolved never again to take for granted. Everybody gives thanks for being alive, but who stops to offer thanks for the bare-bones gerund that comes before alive? I had just come from a place where being was no more and now vowed never to forget what a gift and mystery it is, that there is something rather than nothing. I had entered a familiar and more congenial mental space, one in which I was still tripping but could put together thoughts and direct them here or there. I make no claims as to their quality. Before I drew the smoke into my lungs, Rocio had asked me, as she asks everyone who meets the toad, to search the experience for a peace offering, some idea or resolution I could bring back and put to good use in my life. Mine, I decided, had to do with the question of being and what I took to be its opposite term, doing. I meditated on this duality, which came to seem momentous, and concluded that I was too much occupied with the latter term in my life and not enough with the former. True, one had to favor doing in order to get anything done, but wasn't there also a great virtue and psychic benefit in simply being, in contemplation rather than action? I decided I needed to practice being with stillness, being with other people as I find them, imperfect, and being with my own unimproved self, to savor whatever is at this very moment without trying to change it or even describe it. Huxley struggled with the same aspiration during his mescaline journey. If one always saw like this, one would never want to do anything else. Even now, borne along on this pleasant contemplative stream, I had to resist the urge to drag myself onto shore and tell Rocio about my big breakthrough. No, I had to remind myself, just be with it. Judith and I had had a fight the previous night that I realized turned on this distinction and on my impatience with being. She was complaining about something she doesn't like about her life, and rather than simply commiserate, being with her in her dilemma, I immediately went to the checklist of practical things she might do to fix it. But this was not at all what she wanted or needed, and she got angry. Now I could see with perfect clarity why my attempt to be helpful had been so hurtful. So that was my peace offering, to be more and do less. But as soon as I put it that way, I realized there was a problem, a big problem, in fact. For wasn't the very act of resolving to favor being a form of doing? A betrayal of the whole idea? A true connoisseur of being would never dream of making resolutions. I had tied myself up in a philosophical knot, constructed a paradox or koan I was clearly not smart enough or sufficiently enlightened to untangle. And so what had begun as one of the most shattering experiences of my life ended a half hour later with a wan smile. Even now, many months later, I still don't know exactly what to make of this last trip. Its violent narrative arc, that awful climax followed so swiftly by such a sweet denouement, upended the form of a story or journey. It lacked the beginning, middle, and end that all my previous trips had had, and that we rely on to make sense of experience. That and its mind-bending velocity made it difficult to extract much information or knowledge from the journey, except for the classic psychedelic platitude about the importance of being. A few days after my encounter with the toad, I happened on an old email from James Fadiman that ended uncannily with these words, which you should picture arranged on the screen like a poem. I hope whatever you're doing, you're stopping now and then and not doing it at all. The integration had been cursory, leaving me to puzzle out the toad's teachings, such as they were, on my own. Had I had any sort of spiritual or mystical experience, or was what took place in my mind merely the epiphenomenon of these strange molecules, or was it both? Olivia's words echoed, "It's an irrelevant question. This was something being revealed to me." What, if anything, had been revealed to me? Not sure exactly where to begin, I realized it might be useful to measure my experiences against those of the volunteers in the Hopkins and NYU studies. I decided to fill out one of the mystical experience questionnaires, MEQs, that the scientists had their subjects complete, hoping to learn if mine qualified. The MEQ asked me to rank a list of 30 mental phenomena, thoughts, images, and sensations that psychologists and philosophers regard as typical of a mystical experience. The questionnaire draws on the work of William James, W.T. Stace, and Walter Pahnke. Looking back on the entirety of your session, please rate the degree to which at any time you experience the following phenomena using a 6-point scale, from 0 for none at all to 5 for extreme, more than any other time in my life. Some items were easy to rate. Loss of your usual sense of time? Check, 5. Experience of amazement? Uh-huh. Another 5. Sense that the experience cannot be described adequately in words? Yep, 5 again. Gain of insightful knowledge experienced at an intuitive level? I guess the platitude about being would qualify, maybe a 3? But I was unsure what to do with this one. Feeling that you experienced eternity or infinity? The language implied something more positive than what I felt when time vanished and terror took hold. N.A., I decided. The experience of the fusion of your personal self into a larger whole also seemed like an overly nice way to put the sensation of becoming one with a nuclear blast. It seemed less fusion than fission, but okay, I gave it a 4. And what to do with this one? Certainty of encounter with ultimate reality, in the sense of being able to know and see what is really real at some point in your experience. I might have emerged from the experience with certain convictions, the one about being and doing, say, but these hardly seem like encounters with ultimate reality, whatever that is. Similarly, a few other items made me want to throw up my hands. Feeling that you experience something profoundly sacred and holy? No. Or experience of the insight all is one? Yes, but not in a good way. In the midst of that all-consuming mindstorm, there was nothing I missed more than differentiation and multiplicity. Struggling to assign ratings to a handful of such items, I felt the survey pulling me in the direction of a conclusion that was not at all consistent with what I felt. But when I tallied my score, I was surprised. I had scored a 61, 1 point over the threshold for a complete mystical experience. I had squeaked through. So that was a mystical experience? It didn't feel at all like what I expected a mystical experience to be. I concluded that the MEQ was a poor net for capturing my encounter with the toad. The result was psychological bycatch, I decided, and should probably be tossed out. Yet I wonder if my dissatisfaction with the survey had something to do with the intrinsic nature, the sheer intensity and bizarre shape of the toad experience, for which it wasn't designed, after all. Because when I used the same survey to evaluate my psilocybin journey, the fit seemed much better, and rating the phenomena much easier. Reflecting just on the cello interlude, for example, I could easily confirm the fusion of my personal self into a larger whole, as well as the feeling that I experienced something profoundly sacred and holy, and of being at a spiritual height, and even the experience of unity with ultimate reality. Yes, 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 and yes. Provided, that is, that my endorsement of those loaded adjectives doesn't imply any belief in a supernatural reality. My psilocybin journey with Mary yielded a 66 on the mystical experience questionnaire. For some reason, I felt stupidly proud of my score. There I was again, doing being. It had been my objective to have such an experience, and at least according to the scientists, a mystical experience I had had. Yet it had brought me no closer to a belief in God, or in a cosmic form of consciousness, or in anything magical at all. All of which I might have been unreasonably expecting, hoping it might do. Still, there was no question that something novel and profound had happened to me, something I am prepared to call spiritual, though only with an asterisk. I guess I've always assumed that spirituality implied a belief or faith I've never shared and from which it supposedly flows. But now I wondered, is this always or necessarily the case? Only in the wake of my journeys have I been able to unravel the paradox that had so perplexed me when I interviewed Dinah Baser, an NYU cancer patient who began and ended her psilocybin experience an avowed atheist. During the climax of a journey that extinguished her fear of death, Baser described being bathed in God's love, and yet she emerged with her atheism intact. How could someone hold those two warring ideas in the same brain? I think I get it now. Not only was the flood of love she experienced ineffably powerful, but it was unattributable to any individual or worldly cause, and so was purely gratuitous, a form of grace. So how to convey the magnitude of such a gift? God might be the only word in the language big enough. Part of the problem I was having evaluating my own experience had to do with another big and loaded word, mystical, implying as it does an experience beyond the reach of ordinary comprehension or science. It reeks of the supernatural. Yet I think it would be wrong to discard the mystical if only because so much work has been done by so many great minds over literally thousands of years to find the words for this extraordinary human experience and make sense of it. When we read the testimony of these minds, we find a striking commonality in their descriptions, even if we civilians can't quite understand what in the world or out of it they're talking about. According to scholars of mysticism, these shared traits generally include a vision of unity in which all things, including the self, are subsumed, expressed in the phrase all is one, a sense of certainty about what one has perceived, knowledge has been revealed to me, feelings of joy, blessedness, and satisfaction, a transcendence of the categories we rely on to organize the world, such as time and space or self and other, a sense that whatever has been apprehended is somehow sacred, Wordsworth wrote, something far more deeply interfused with meaning, and often paradoxical, so while the self may vanish, awareness abides. Last is the conviction that the experience is ineffable, even as thousands of words are expended in the attempt to communicate its power. Guilty. Before my journeys, words and phrases such as these left me cold. They seemed utterly opaque, so much quasi-religious mumbo-jumbo. Now, they paint a recognizable reality. Likewise, certain mystical passages from literature that once seemed so overstated and abstract that I read them indulgently, if at all, now I can read as a subspecies of journalism. Here are three 19th-century examples, but you can find them in any century. Ralph Waldo Emerson, crossing a wintry New England commons in his essay Nature. Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part or particle of God. Or Walt Whitman, in the early lines of the first, much briefer and more mystical edition of Leaves of Grass. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and joy and knowledge that pass all the art and argument of the earth. And I know that the hand of God is the elder hand of my own, and I know that the spirit of God is the eldest brother of my own, and that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers, and that a kelson of the creation is love. Kelson is a nautical term for a structural member in the hull of a boat. And here is Alfred Lord Tennyson describing in a letter the waking trance that descended upon him from time to time since his boyhood. All at once, as it were out of the intensity of the consciousness of individuality, the individuality itself seemed to dissolve and fade into boundless being. And this was not a confused state. but the clearest of the clearest, the surest of the surest, utterly beyond words, where death was an almost laughable impossibility, the loss of personality, if so it were, seeming no extinction, but the only true life. What had changed for me was that now I understood exactly what these writers were talking about, their own mystical experiences, however achieved, however interpreted. Formerly inert, their words now emitted a new ray of relation, or at least I was now in a position to receive it. Such emissions had always been present in our world, flowing through literature and religion, but like electromagnetic waves, they couldn't be understood without some kind of receiver. I had become such a one. A phrase like boundless being, which once I might have skated past as overly abstract and hyperbolic, now communicated something specific and even familiar. A door had opened for me onto a realm of human experience that for 60 years had been closed. Or at least 55 years, because I think young children have ready access to these kinds of experiences, as we will see in the next chapter. But had I earned the right to go through that door, enter into that conversation? I don't know about Emerson's mystical experience or Whitman's or Tennyson's, but mine owed to a chemical. Wasn't that cheating? Perhaps not. It seems likely that all mental experiences are mediated by chemicals in the brain, even the most seemingly transcendent. How much should the genealogy of these chemicals matter? It turns out that the very same molecules flow through the natural world and the human brain, linking us all together in a vast watershed of tryptamines. Are these exogenous molecules any less miraculous when they come from a mushroom or a plant or a toad? It's worth remembering that there are many cultures where the fact that the inspiration for visionary experience comes from nature, is the gift of other creatures, renders them more meaningful, not less. My own interpretation of what I experienced, my now officially verified mystical experience, remains a work in progress, still in search of the right words. But I have no problem using the word spiritual to describe elements of what I saw and felt, as long as it is not taken in a supernatural sense. For me, spiritual is a good name for some of the powerful mental phenomena that arise when the voice of the ego is muted or silenced. If nothing else, these journeys have shown me how that psychic construct, at once so familiar and on reflection so strange, stands between us and some striking new dimensions of experience, whether of the world outside us or of the mind within. The journeys have shown me what the Buddhists tried to tell us, but I have never really understood, that there is much more to consciousness than the ego, as we would see if it would just shut up, and that its dissolution or transcendence is nothing to fear. In fact, it is a prerequisite for making any spiritual progress. But the ego, that inner neurotic who insists on running the mental show, is wily and doesn't relinquish its power without a struggle. Deeming itself indispensable, it will battle against its diminishment, whether in advance or in the middle of the journey. I suspect that's exactly what mine was up to all through the sleepless nights that preceded each of my trips, striving to convince me that I was risking everything, when really all I was putting at risk was its sovereignty. When Huxley speaks of the mind's reducing valve, the faculty that eliminates as much of the world from our conscious awareness as it lets in, he is talking about the ego. That stingy, vigilant security guard admits only the narrowest bandwidth of reality, a measly trickle of the kind of consciousness which will help us to stay alive. It's really good at performing all those activities that natural selection values, getting ahead, getting liked and loved, getting fed, getting laid. Keeping us on task, it is a ferocious editor of anything that might distract us from the work at hand, whether that means regulating our access to memories and strong emotions from within or news of the world without. What of the world it does admit, it tends to objectify, for the ego wants to reserve the gifts of subjectivity to itself. That's why it fails to see that there is a whole world of souls and spirits out there, by which I simply mean subjectivities other than our own. It was only when the voice of my ego was quieted by psilocybin that I was able to sense that the plants in my garden had a spirit too. In the words of R.M. Buck, a 19th century Canadian psychiatrist and mystic, I saw that the universe is not composed of dead matter, but is, on the contrary, a living presence. Ecology and coevolution are scientific names for the same phenomenon, every species a subject acting on other subjects. But when this concept acquires the flesh of feeling, becomes more deeply interfused, as it did during my first psilocybin journey, I'm happy to call it a spiritual experience. So too my various psychedelic mergings, with Bach's cello suite, with my son Isaac, with my grandfather Bob, all spirits directly apprehended and embraced, each time with a flood of feeling. So perhaps spiritual experience is simply what happens in the space that opens up in the mind when all mean egotism vanishes. Wonders and terrors we're ordinarily defended against flow into our awareness. The far ends of the sensory spectrum, which are normally invisible to us, our senses can suddenly admit. While the ego sleeps, the mind plays, proposing unexpected patterns of thought and new rays of relation. The gulf between self and world, that no man's land, which in ordinary hours the ego so vigilantly patrols, closes down, allowing us to feel less separate and more connected, part and particle of some larger entity. Whether we call that entity nature, the mind at large, or God hardly matters, but it seems to be in the crucible of that merging that death loses some of its sting. Chapter 5. The Neuroscience, Your Brain on Psychedelics. What just happened in my brain? A molecule had launched me on each of these trips, and I returned from my travels intensely curious to learn what the chemistry could tell me about consciousness and what that might reveal about the brain's relationship to the mind. How do you get from the ingestion of a compound created by a fungus or a toad or a human chemist to a novel state of consciousness with the power to change one's perspective on things, not just during the journey, but long after the molecule has left the body? Actually, there were three different molecules in question. Psilocin, LSD, and 5-MeO-DMT. But even a casual glance at their structures, and I say this as someone who earned a D in high school chemistry, indicates a resemblance. All three molecules are tryptamines. A tryptamine is a type of organic compound, an indole to be exact, distinguished by the presence of two linked rings, one of them with six atoms and the other with five. Living nature is awash in tryptamines, which show up in plants, fungi, and animals, where they typically act as signaling molecules between cells. The most famous tryptamine in the human body is the neurotransmitter serotonin, the chemical name of which is 5-hydroxytryptamine. It is no coincidence that this molecule has a strong family resemblance with the psychedelic molecules. Serotonin might be famous as neurotransmitters go, yet much about it remains a mystery. For example, it binds with a dozen or so different receptors, and these are found not only across many parts of the brain, but throughout the body, with a substantial representation in the digestive tract. Depending on the type of receptor in question and its location, serotonin is liable to make very different things happen, sometimes exciting a neuron to fire, other times inhibiting it. Think of it as a kind of word, the meaning or import of which can change radically depending on the context or even its placement in a sentence. The group of tryptamines we call the classical psychedelics have a strong affinity with one particular type of serotonin receptor called the 5-HT2A. These receptors are found in large numbers in the human cortex, the outermost and evolutionarily most recent layer of the brain. Basically, the psychedelics resemble serotonin closely enough that they can attach themselves to this receptor site in such a way as to activate it to do various things. Curiously, LSD has an even stronger affinity with the 5-HT2A receptor is stickier than serotonin itself, making this an instance where the simulacrum is more convincing chemically than the original. This has led some scientists to speculate that the human body must produce some other, more bespoke chemical for the express purpose of activating the 5-HT2A receptor, perhaps an endogenous psychedelic that is released under certain circumstances, perhaps when dreaming. One candidate for that chemical is the psychedelic molecule DMT, which has been found in trace amounts in the pineal gland of rats. The science of serotonin and LSD has been closely intertwined since the 1950s. In fact, it was the discovery that LSD affected consciousness at such infinitesimal doses that helped to advance the new field of neurochemistry in the 1950s, leading to the development of the SSRI antidepressants. But it wasn't until 1998 that Franz Wohlenweider, a Swiss researcher who is one of the pioneers of psychedelic neuroscience, demonstrated that psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin work on the human brain by binding with the 5-HT2A receptors. He did this by giving subjects a drug called ketonserin that blocks the receptor. When he then administered psilocybin, nothing happened. Yet Wohlenweider's discovery, important as it was, is but a small step on the long and winding road from psychedelic chemistry to psychedelic consciousness. The 5-HT2A receptor might be the lock on the door to the mind that those three molecules unlock, but how did that chemical opening lead ultimately to what I felt and experienced? To the dissolution of my ego, for example, and the collapse of any distinction between subject and object. Or to the morphing in my mind's eye of Mary into Maria Sabina. Put another way, what, if anything, can brain chemistry tell us about the phenomenology of the psychedelic experience? All these questions concern the contents of consciousness, of course, which at least to this point has eluded the tools of neuroscience. By consciousness, I don't mean simply being conscious, the basic sensory awareness creatures have of changes in their environment, which is easy to measure experimentally. In this limited sense, even plants are conscious, though it's doubtful they possess full-blown consciousness. What neuroscientists and philosophers and psychologists mean by consciousness is the unmistakable sense we have that we are or possess a self that has experiences. Sigmund Freud wrote that, quote, "There is nothing of which we are more certain than the feeling of our self, our own ego." Yet it is difficult to be quite so certain that anyone else possesses consciousness, much less other creatures, because there is no outward physical evidence that consciousness as we experience it exists. The thing of which we are most certain is beyond the reach of our science, supposedly our surest way of knowing anything. This dilemma has left ajar a door through which writers and philosophers have stepped. The classic thought experiment to determine whether another being is in possession of consciousness was proposed by Thomas Nagel, a philosopher, in a famous 1974 paper, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? He argued that if, quote, "there is something that it is like to be a bat, if there is any subjective dimension to bat experience, then a bat possesses consciousness." He went on to suggest that this what it is like quality may not be reducible to material terms, ever. Whether or not Nagel's right about that is the biggest argument going in the field of consciousness studies. The question at its heart is often referred to as the hard problem or the explanatory gap. How do you explain mind, the subjective quality of experience, in terms of meat, that is, in terms of the physical structures or chemistry of the brain? The question assumes, as most but not all scientists do, that consciousness is a product of brains and that it will eventually be explained as the epiphenomenon of material things like neurons and brain structures, chemicals, and communications networks. That would certainly seem to be the most parsimonious hypothesis, yet it is a long way from being proven, and a number of neuroscientists question whether it ever will be, whether something as elusive as subjective experience, what it feels like to be you, will ever yield to the reductions of science. These scientists and philosophers are sometimes called mysterians, which is not meant as a compliment. Some scientists have raised the possibility that consciousness may pervade the universe, suggesting we think of it the same way we do electromagnetism or gravity as one of the fundamental building blocks of reality. The idea that psychedelic drugs might shed some light on the problems of consciousness makes a certain sense. A psychedelic drug is powerful enough to disrupt the system we call normal waking consciousness in ways that may force some of its fundamental properties into view. True, anesthetics disrupt consciousness too, yet because such drugs shut it down, this kind of disturbance yields relatively little data. In contrast, someone on a psychedelic remains awake and able to report on what he or she is experiencing in real time. Nowadays, these subjective reports can be correlated with various measures of brain activity using several different modes of imaging, tools unavailable to researchers during the first wave of psychedelic research in the 1950s and 1960s. By deploying these technologies in combination with LSD and psilocybin, a handful of scientists working in both Europe and the United States are opening a new window onto consciousness. And what they are glimpsing through it promises to change our understanding of the links between our brains and our minds. Perhaps the most ambitious neuroscientific expedition using psychedelics to map the terrain of human consciousness is taking place in a laboratory at the Center for Psychiatry on the Hammersmith campus of Imperial College in West London. Recently completed, the campus consists of a futuristic but oddly depressing network of buildings linked by glass-walled aerial walkways and glass doors that slide open silently at the detection of the proper identification. It is here in the lab of David Nutt, a prominent English psychopharmacologist, that a team led by a 30-something neuroscientist named Robin Carhart-Harris has been working since 2009 to identify the neural correlates, or physical counterparts, of the psychedelic experience. By injecting volunteers with LSD and psilocybin and then using a variety of scanning technologies, including functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, and magnetoencephalography, MEG, to observe the changes in their brains. He and his team have given us our first glimpses of what something like ego dissolution or a hallucination actually looks like in the brain as it unfolds in the mind. The fact that such an improbable and potentially controversial research project ever got off the ground owes to the convergence of three most unusual characters and careers in England in the year 2005. David Nutt, Robin Carhart-Harris, and Amanda Fielding, a.k.a. the Countess of Weems and March. Robin Carhart-Harris's path to David Nutt's psychopharmacology lab was an eccentric one, having first passed through a graduate course in psychoanalysis. These days, psychoanalysis is a theory few neuroscientists take seriously, regarding it less as a science than a set of untestable beliefs. Carhart-Harris felt strongly otherwise. Steeped in the writings of Freud and Jung, he was fascinated by psychoanalytic theory, while at the same time frustrated by its lack of scientific rigor, as well as by the limitations of its tools for exploring what it deemed most important about the mind, the unconscious. If the only way we can access the unconscious is via dreams and free association, he explained the first time we talked, we aren't going to get anywhere. Surely there must be something else. One day he asked his seminar professor if that something else might be a drug. I asked Robin if his hunch was based on personal experience or research, but he made clear this was not a subject he wished to discuss. His professor sent him to read a book called Realms of the Human Unconscious, by Stanislav Grof. I went to the library and read the book cover to cover. I was blown away. That set the course for the rest of my young life. Carhart-Harris, who is a slender, intense young man in a hurry with a neatly trimmed beard and large, pale blue eyes that seldom blink, formulated a plan it would take him a few years to put into motion. He would use psychedelic drugs and modern brain imaging technologies to build a foundation of hard science beneath the edifice of psychoanalysis. Freud said dreams were the royal road to the unconscious, he reminded me. Psychedelics could turn out to be the superhighway. Carhart-Harris's demeanor is modest, even humble, offering no clue to the audacity of his ambition. He likes to quote Grof's grand claim that what the telescope was for astronomy or the microscope for biology, psychedelics will be for understanding the mind. Carhart-Harris completed his master's in psychoanalysis in 2005 and began to plot his move into the neuroscience of psychedelics. He asked around and did some internet research that eventually led him to David Nutt and Amanda Fielding as two people who might be interested in his project and in a position to help. He first approached Fielding, who in 1998 had established something called the Beckley Foundation to study the effects of psychoactive substances on the brain and to lobby for drug policy reform. The foundation is named for Beckley Park, the sprawling 14th century Tudor manor where she grew up in Oxfordshire, and where in 2005 she invited Carhart-Harris to lunch. On a recent visit of my own to Beckley, I counted 2 towers and 3 moats. Amanda Fielding, who was born in 1943, is an eccentric as only the English aristocracy can breed them. She's descended from the House of Habsburg and 2 of Charles II's illegitimate children. A student of comparative religion and mysticism, Fielding has had a long-standing interest in altered states of consciousness, and specifically the role of blood flow in the brain, which in Homo sapiens, she believes, has been compromised ever since our species began standing upright. LSD, Fielding believes, enhances cognitive function and facilitates higher states of consciousness by increasing cerebral circulation. A second way to achieve a similar result is by means of the ancient practice of trepanation. This deserves a brief digression. Trepanation involves drilling a shallow hole in the skull, supposedly to improve cerebral blood circulation. In effect, it reverses the fusing of the cranial bones that happens in childhood. Trepanation was for centuries a common medical procedure, to judge by the number of ancient skulls that have turned up with neat holes in them. Convinced that trepanation would help facilitate higher states of consciousness, Fielding went looking for someone to perform the operation on her. When it became clear no professional would oblige, she trepaned herself in 1970, boring a small hole in the middle of her forehead with an electric drill. She documented the procedure in a short but horrifying film called Heartbeat in the Brain. Pleased with the results, Fielding went on to stand for election to Parliament twice on a platform of trepanation for the national health. But while Amanda Fielding may be eccentric, she is by no means feckless. Her work on both drug research and drug policy reform has been serious, strategic, and productive. In recent years, her focus has shifted from trepanation to the potential of psychedelics to improve brain function. In her own life, she has used LSD as a kind of brain tonic, favoring a daily dose that she says hits that sweet spot where creativity and enthusiasm is increased, but control is maintained. She told me there was a time when she put that tonic dose at 150 micrograms, far above a microdose, and enough to send most people, myself included, on a full-fledged trip. But because frequent use of LSD can lead to tolerance, it's entirely possible that for some people, 150 micrograms merely adds a certain sparkle to consciousness, as she says. I found Fielding to be disarmingly frank about the baggage she brings to the new conversation about psychedelic science. I'm a druggie, I live in this big house, and I have a hole in my head. I guess that disqualifies me. So when an aspiring young scientist named Robin Carhart Harris came for lunch at Beckley in 2005, sharing his ambition to combine research into LSD and Freud, Fielding immediately saw the potential, as well as an opportunity to put her theories about cerebral blood circulation to the test. Fielding indicated to Carhart Harris that her foundation might be willing to fund such research and suggested that he contact David Nutt, then a professor at the University of Bristol and an ally of Fielding's in the campaign to reform drug policy. In his own way, David Nutt is as notorious in England as Amanda Fielding. Nutt, who is a large, jolly fellow in his 60s with a mustache and a booming laugh, achieved his particular notoriety in 2009. That's when the Home Secretary fired him from the government's advisory council on the misuse of drugs, of which he had been chair. The committee is charged with advising the government on the classification of illicit drugs based on their risk to individuals and society. Nutt, who is an expert on addiction and on the class of drugs called benzodiazepines, such as Valium, had committed the fatal political error of quantifying empirically the risks of various psychoactive substances, both legal and illegal. He had concluded from his research and would tell anyone who asked that alcohol was more dangerous than cannabis and that using ecstasy was safer than riding a horse. But the sentence that got me sacked, he told me when we met in his office at Imperial, was when I went on live breakfast television. I was asked, "You're not seriously telling us that LSD is less harmful than alcohol, are you?" "Of course I am." In his 2012 book, Drugs Without the Hot Air, Nutt writes that psychedelics overall are among the safest drugs we know of. It's virtually impossible to die from an overdose of them. They cause no physical harm, and if anything, they're anti-addictive. Robin Carhart Harris came to see David Nutt in 2005, hoping to study psychedelics and dreaming under him at Bristol. Trying to be strategic, he mentioned the possibility of funding from Fielding. As Carhart Harris recalls the interview, Nutt was blunt in his dismissal. "The idea you want to do is incredibly far-fetched. You have no neuroscience experience. It's completely unrealistic. But I told him I had put all my eggs in this basket." Impressed by the young man's determination, Nutt made him an offer. "Come do a PhD with me. We'll start with something straightforward." This turned out to be the effect of MDMA on the serotonin system. "And then maybe later on we can do psychedelics." Later on came in 2009 when Carhart Harris, armed with a PhD and working in Nutt's lab with funding from Amanda Fielding, received approval from the National Health Service and the Home Office to study the effect of psilocybin on the brain. LSD would come a few years later. Carhart Harris put himself forward as the first volunteer. "If you're going to give this drug to people and put them in a scanner," I thought, "the honest thing is to do it first to yourself." But, as he told Nutt, "I have an anxious disposition and may not have been in the best place psychologically." So he dissuaded me. He also thought participating in the experiment might compromise my objectivity. In the end, a colleague became the first volunteer to receive an injection of psilocybin and then slide into an fMRI scanner to have his tripping brain imaged. Carhart Harris's working hypothesis was that their brains would exhibit increases in activity, particularly in the emotion centers. "I thought it would look like the dreaming brain," he told me. Employing a different scanning technology, Franz Vollenweider had published data indicating that psychedelics stimulated brain activity, especially in the frontal lobes, an area responsible for executive and other higher cognitive functions. But when the first set of data came in, Carhart Harris got a surprise. "We were seeing decreases in blood flow," blood flow being one of the proxies for brain activity that fMRI measures. Had we made a mistake? It was a real head-scratcher. But the initial data on blood flow was corroborated by a second measure that looks at changes in oxygen consumption to pinpoint areas of elevated brain activity. Carhart Harris and his colleagues had discovered that psilocybin reduces brain activity, with the fall-off concentrated in one particular brain network that at the time he knew little about, the default mode network. Carhart Harris began reading up on it. The default mode network, or DMN, was not known to brain science until 2001. That was when Marcus Raichel, a neurologist at Washington University, described it in a landmark paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS. The network forms a critical and centrally located hub of brain activity that links parts of the cerebral cortex to deeper and older structures involved in memory and emotion. The discovery of the default mode network was actually a scientific accident, a happy byproduct of the use of brain imaging technologies in brain research. The typical fMRI experiment begins by establishing a resting state baseline for neural activity as the volunteer sits quietly in the scanner awaiting whatever tests the researcher has in store. Raichel had noticed that several areas in the brain exhibited heightened activity precisely when his subjects were doing nothing mentally. This was the brain's default mode, the network of brain structures that light up with activity when there are no demands on our attention and we have no mental task to perform. Put another way, Raichel had discovered the place where our minds go to wander, to daydream, ruminate, travel in time, reflect on ourselves, and worry. It may be through these very structures that the stream of our consciousness flows. The default network stands in a kind of seesaw relationship with the attentional networks that wake up whenever the outside world demands our attention. When one is active, the other goes quiet, and vice versa. But as any person can tell you, quite a lot happens in the mind when nothing much is going on outside us. In fact, the DMN consumes a disproportionate share of the brain's energy. Working at a remove from our sensory processing of the outside world, the default mode is most active when we are engaged in higher-level metacognitive processes such as self-reflection, mental time travel, mental constructions such as the self or ego, moral reasoning, and theory of mind, the ability to attribute mental states to others, as when we try to imagine what it is like to be someone else. All these functions may belong exclusively to humans, and specifically to adult humans, for the default mode network isn't operational until late in a child's development. The brain is a hierarchical system, Carhart-Harris explained in one of our interviews. The highest level parts, those developed late in our evolution, typically located in the cortex, exert an inhibitory influence on the lower level and older parts, like emotion and memory. As a whole, the default mode network exerts a top-down influence on other parts of the brain, many of which